Check, check. Hey, there I am. Hi, guys. Now I can talk to you. This is great. I've never used one of these headsets before, so I'm enjoying the feeling, the power. I've used microphones 100 times, but yeah, these ones. I just love it. I'm free now. I can use both hands. I can walk around, not wired in somewhere. It's great. So, Joe said, my name is Ben. He's right. I am Ben. I will introduce myself. I'm from Oregon, but I'm not visiting from Oregon. I live in Craig now, and that's Stephanie's fault. So, I came here. Thanks. I came here in May. I mean, I visited for a couple years, dated this girl named Stephanie. She's pretty cool. And decided to marry her, which I didn't realize at the time came with the obligation of moving to Craig and finding out what it's like to live in a small town. I'm from the town of Medford, Oregon, so there's like 250,000 people there. We have Costco, and it's great. Costco makes a big difference. Mainly the free samples. I never had a membership, but my mom did, so. Okay, so this is fun. I met Steph in the mission field, so I might as well talk about that for a minute. We were serving together in Chico, California in the year 2018. 6 years ago, Steph, in September. My goodness. She came as a student to do her discipleship training school. I think you were 20, right? Fresh out of your associates here at the community college. You guys sent her. I don't know if you remember, it was 6 years ago, but you were like, bye, Steph. And she showed up in California, and I was like, hi. So she and I got to know each other a little bit in that time, and, you know, had our getting to know each other, friendship, dating, married phase, and all of that. But all of that's in the context of being missionaries with Youth with a Mission. So I joined Youth with a Mission at the age of 18. I graduated high school, got on a flight out of our small airport in Oregon, not quite as small as this one, but a small airport, and I flew to Chile, South America. That's this really long country left of Argentina. It's about as long as New York to Los Angeles, but it's north to south. So you've got desert in the north, and you've got Alaska in the south. It's beautiful country. I spent a year and a half there, did my discipleship training school as sort of a initial entry to missions. And from that place, right after that school, 7 days later, I started my school of biblical studies, where I spent 9 months reading the Bible. Have you ever spent 9 months reading the Bible? Good. It's a good thing to do. We read it 5 times. We studied it in depth using the inductive method. Some of you may be familiar with that, but essentially it's just to say, read the text, understand the context, ask a lot of questions, read it like 5 times or so, and then do something about it. That's the trick. Reading the Bible is a waste of time if you don't do anything about it. So, do something about it. Read it, get something out of it, and do what God has put in his text. That one's for free. So, from there I went on some outreaches, went to Thailand, Peru, Brazil, Argentina, Denmark, Spain, Mexico. We went back to Mexico a lot. And it was an awesome time. I moved to California at some point in that journey, met Steph. We took some outreaches to Mexico as well. An outreach is like a 2-month time, 3-month time, where we go. We live in the villages, live with the people, and preach in the churches and share and disciple communities. And so, yeah, that was a really good time. You might notice that I spent most of that time in Latin America. That's because I'm called the Latin America. So God is doing something in the church right now. North America, USA, Europe, these parts of the world used to be the core of Christianity. Missions went out from there to Africa, South America, Asia, indigenous peoples all over the place. And Christianity came from Europe and North America to the rest of the world. That was true for a long time until around the 60s, 70s, we started seeing a shift in the global church. First off, here in the North, America, Europe, we started seeing a decline in church membership, church-going people. Those who go to church became more watered down. Missions became less of a focus. The call of God to a sacrificial life, to lay our lives down for Jesus, because he laid our lives down for us as an example for us to follow, was, I don't want to say it was lost, because that's dramatic, but it's kind of lost. There's a lot of people who are called, and they don't know how to go anymore. But the global South, South America, Africa, these parts of the world are where the church is growing faster than ever. These parts of the world are where you see 90% of the country is going to church. You're seeing greater missions movements coming out of Brazil now than North America. We did some numbers a little while ago. The USA is still the top, just barely. It's got our little sliver of we send the most missionaries and give the most money to missions, right? But the next one is North Korea. South Korea. A little different. There's a thriving church movement in North Korea, but we don't talk about it. Because we want them to live. South Korea sends the second most in the world right now. And Brazil sends the third most. But Brazil probably sends the second most because they don't do their numbers very well. So they're a little bit, just go. It's great. We love it. I encounter Brazilians everywhere in missions. And so Latin America right now is where my heart's at. And God's vision right now for the church is just aware that the global South is the leader of the next generation of Christianity and of missions. And so our calling to Latin America, together with Steph, our calling to Latin America is to equip and send Latinos to America, to Africa, to India, to China, wherever they need to go, wherever God calls them. So that's a bit of us, our vision, our life, our passion. And I guess I came here to preach, so I'll do that. Cool. So, I titled this sermon, Expecting New Life. Not because we're pregnant, we're not, but because there's two types of people in the world. And I know most people say that, and it's an overgeneralization, but this one isn't, I promise. There's two types. There's living people and dead people. I can't find anyone outside of those categories. Christianity is often dead or alive. The church has living Christians and dead Christians. What do I mean by that? Not that in Jesus we're not given new life. We are given new life. That's actually the point of this. But oftentimes we live in a way where we keep Jesus in a box. We keep our expectations of him very rigid, and he has to show up at this time in this way on Sunday. And that's it for Jesus and for our lives. And then there's another kind of Christianity where Jesus is very outside the box, where we don't know what to expect, but we show up every day expecting. And I want to talk about how to get from dead to alive. So, to begin, let me just share a little story I think some might relate to. Some of the younger people here especially will remember when they got their first cell phone. Well, I guess the older people also got their first cell phone at some point, right? But I got my first cell phone when I was like 14, not when I was 50, so there's a difference. I was talking to my parents, I'm like, man, all my friends have cell phones. You know, since I was 10, they all had a little smartphone or something. Well, iPhones kind of came out when I was 10, so I'm not that young, but people nowadays, dude, they're like 6, they're 4, and parents are giving them an iPhone 13 Pro Max, and it's like, here, watch your kids' YouTube videos to just entertain them, right? So when I was like 10 to 14, I was like, oh, my friends have phones, and I told my parents, hey, I want a phone. Of course I want a phone. Who doesn't, you know? I want to text my friends, want to play the games, want to get on Google, learn things, whatever. So I was like 14, and my parents finally were like, okay, we'll get you a phone. So they got me a phone, and it was about this big, and it had a keyboard that slid out, so it was slightly better than having to punch the number like 4 times to get the letter I want, but it slid out, and I texted like this with my fingers, and it didn't have a camera, didn't have a web browser, I couldn't Google anything on my phone, but I could send some texts, so that was nice. And that's what they got me when I was 14. I was hoping for an iPhone. My dad had an iPhone. He had an old iPhone that was sitting in a drawer unused. It didn't get to be mine. And they said, when you're 18, you can buy yourself whatever you want. So I grew up very disappointed. I expected an iPhone, and I got a little slide-out thingy. I still remember the phone number for it because I had to memorize the number back then. It was great. So that was a interesting moment, though, because I realized now, 10 years later, and I'm 26, so 12 years later, my parents did me a favor. They gave me an opportunity to watch the people around me get sucked into this thing and die a little bit inside. They get sucked into this screen, and all their relationships are through a screen now. When they're sitting together at a coffee shop, they're looking at their phones together. I guess that's a relationship. It's weird. So I got to watch these people get addicted to their phones, and, well, I got to make my own decision later. Of course, you know, I'll still scroll on Instagram or something sometimes, but I do find that I have an easier time just not looking at my phone for an hour. It doesn't hurt me. For a lot of people, it seems to hurt them. So I realized my parents did me a favor. They held something back from me, even though it's what I expected, it's what I asked for, and what they did for me instead brought me life. So, that's a little example of something we're going to go into. But essentially, let's change it from a phone. Let's talk about Jesus. We expect Jesus to show up in a certain way at a certain time and do a certain thing for us. And when he doesn't, we get mad at him. And we're like, Dad, you didn't give me that iPhone. Oh, wait, no. We say, Jesus, you didn't, you know, heal my cold in time for me to go to that meeting. Or sometimes heavier things. Sometimes we lose somebody. Sometimes we lose a job. Sometimes we lose that house we were trying to buy. And Jesus didn't do it. Because it's, well, he's not always what we expect, right? There's an amazing story in the Bible where we see Jesus leading people into death. Leading people into a place where, sorry, let me back up. Boom. Death is not just dying, right? Death is, from Genesis 1, 2, and 3, we see God says, if you eat from that tree, you will die. What happens? Sickness enters the world, strife, war, hunger, disease. I said sickness and disease, so kind of redundant, but you get the point. Things enter the world that bring bad to us, that bring evil, that bring death, they bring destruction and chaos on us. They don't bring life. The whole Bible is about life and death. It's not about good versus evil, it's about life versus death. So, there's an amazing story, though, in John chapter 11, where Jesus leads people. Thanks. We're going to read that soon. Where Jesus leads people into death, knowing that there is a resurrection coming. Jesus, in this instance, by leading them into death, he shifts their faith from what they expect him to do to believing in who he is. And in doing so, he draws a line that divides people between the people who, when Jesus doesn't do what they expect, they blame him and distance themselves from him, and the people who come closer to him and bring him into the grief and the challenge of the change, and they are the ones who believe and receive life. So, that's my overview of what's to come. Now we're going to do a lot of reading. I like reading the Bible. A lot of people don't. So guess what? There's words up there. That's the Bible. We're going to read John chapter 11, verses 1 through 46. 46 verses. Don't worry. I'll make it as exciting as I can. 46 verses. It's not too much, guys. I read John 5 times one day in my Bible school. You can do it. Just kidding. You guys are amazing Bible scholars. I know it. So, turn on your Bibles to John chapter 11, if you have them. if you want to follow along on your own, I'm going to read from English Standard Version. This, I think, is English Standard Version. We changed it, right, Joe? Awesome. It was NASB. I actually prefer NASB, but I brought my big ESV today, so that's okay. All right. This is the story of the death of a close friend of Jesus named Lazarus and his resurrection. Now, starting in verse 1. Now, a man was ill, Lazarus of Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. It was this Mary who anointed the Lord with ointment and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was ill. So the sister sent to him, saying, Lord, he whom you love is ill. But when Jesus heard it, he said, this illness does not lead to death. It is for the glory of God, so that the Son of God may be glorified through it. Remember that verse. Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. So, when he heard that Lazarus was ill, he stayed 2 days longer in the place where he was in. He loved them, so he waited to show up later. We'll understand this soon. Then after this, he said to the disciples, let us go to Judea again. The disciples said to him, Rabbi, the Jews were just now seeking to stone you, and are you going there again? They're trying to kill him. Jesus answered, are there not 12 hours in the day? If anyone walks in the day, he does not stumble because he sees the light of this world. But if anyone walks in the night, he stumbles because the light is not in him. After saying these things, he said to them, our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I go to awaken him. The disciples said to him, Lord, if he's fallen asleep, he will recover. Now, Jesus had spoken of his death, but they thought he meant he was taking his rest in sleep. Then Jesus told them plainly, Lazarus has died, and for your sake, I am glad that I was not there, so that you may believe. But let us go to him. So Thomas, called the twin, said to his fellow disciples, let us also go, that we may die with him. Thomas, what are you thinking? Now when Jesus came, he found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb for 4 days. Bethany was near Jerusalem, about 2 miles off, and many of the Jews had come to Martha and Mary to console them concerning their brother. So when Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went to him and met him. But Mary remained seated in the house. Martha said to Jesus, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But even now, I know that whatever you ask from God, God will give you. Jesus said to her, your brother will rise again. Martha said to him, I know that he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day. Jesus said to her, I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live. And everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die. Do you believe this? She said to him, yes, Lord, I believe you are the Christ, the Son of God, who is coming into this world. When she had said this, she went and called her sister Mary, saying in private, the teacher is here and is calling for you. And when she heard it, she rose quickly and went to him. Now Jesus had not come into the village, but was still in the place where Martha had met him. When the Jews who were with her in the house, consoling her, saw Mary rise quickly and go out, they followed her, supposing that she was going to the tomb to weep there. Now when Mary came to where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet, saying, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. When Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews who had come with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in his spirit and greatly troubled. And he said, where have you laid him? They said to him, Lord, come and see. Jesus wept. So the Jews said, see how he loved him. But some of them said, could not he who opened the eyes of the blind man also have kept this man from dying? Then Jesus, deeply moved again, came to the tomb. It was a cave, and a stone lay against it. Jesus said, take away the stone. Martha, the sister of the dead man, said to him, Lord, By this time there will be an odor, for he has been dead for 4 days. Jesus said to her, Did I not tell you that if you believe, you will see the glory of God? So they took away the stone. And Jesus lifted up his eyes and said, Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I knew that you always hear me, but I said this on account of the people standing around, that they may believe that you sent me. When he said these things, he cried out with a loud voice, Lazarus, come out! The man who had died came out, his hands and feet bound with linen strips, and his face wrapped with a cloth. Jesus said to them, Unbind him and let him go. Many of the Jews, therefore, who had come with Mary and had seen what he did, believed in him. But some of them went to the Pharisees and told them what Jesus had done. And I'm going to stop there, even though the screen goes on. So, wow, we just read a long story, right? It's actually a short story. We've all read books longer than that. The reason we read this in a whole chunk today, anyway, is because you shouldn't study a story line by line. You got to study the arc of character development, right? Who here took like literature in high school, maybe college? You study a story's arc. You study the plot, the climax. You look at the rising action and the falling action. You look at character development throughout. And we cannot do that if we take one verse out of it. When we read Timothy, for example, I know we've been going through that recently. You can, most of the time, take a verse out, not out of context, still read its context immediately, but that verse itself will have some truth contained in it without necessarily you needing to study every single word, 46 verses around it. That's okay. So we read a whole story because I want to talk about some character development that happened through this. First of all, let's think about the very beginning of this. I think it's the next slide in the group that I put in there. It says something like that. Thank you. So first of all, I'm going to do some discussion of both the story and what we take out of it, right? So Jesus leads us into death knowing that there's life on the other side. But there is not resurrection without a cross or without a grave. I know it's not Resurrection Sunday yet, so that's why we're talking about Lazarus instead of Jesus. Just kidding. Actually, if you read John and you know what the word chiasm means, if you don't, that's okay. But you'll realize that there's a mirror symmetry of how the stories develop from chapter 11 all the way to 20 with the resurrection of Jesus and the resurrection of Lazarus being these mirrored moments. That's for those Bible scholars out there. Have fun. John 15, 1 through 17 is the center of the chiasm. Anyway, that is to say, 15, 1 through 7, about the vine and abiding with Jesus and being close to him, that's the central message to which this acts as a bookend. Resurrection is the bookend to intimacy. So, let's have fun. Okay, so Jesus takes his disciples, right? Someone comes to him, they're like, Jesus, I'm just going to paraphrase a bunch, Jesus, the one who you love is ill and dying, right? Now, we don't know if he was actually already dead. Maybe the messenger was sent out a day before. He'd already died before he even got there. Or maybe the messenger got there and he was still alive, and Jesus waited 2 days for Lazarus to die and then took a 4-day trip down there. We don't exactly know the timeline. One way or another, when Jesus got there, Lazarus was dead for 4 days. However, before that, when the messenger gets to Jesus, Jesus hears him out, says, okay, he's ill. John inserts, because Mary and Martha said, the one you love is ill. John adds a little parenthesis. Jesus loved Mary, Martha, and Lazarus. I love that. Jesus says to his disciples, let's go to Judea. His disciples say, if we go there, we'll die. Jesus says, we're going anyway. Right? Jesus is leading them into the place of death. So these guys, Lazarus has an encounter with death by dying, But the disciples have an encounter with death because they have to go face it. They have to go take courage and walk into Judea, into the land where people want to kill them. This happens all in verses 1 through 16. So, on they go, and Thomas, I love Thomas, he's like, okay guys, let's go die. Let's do it. We're going to go die with him. That's what Thomas said in verse 16. Let's go die. I think it means with Jesus, not with Lazarus, but there's some debate about who is him in this verse. But in any case, Thomas is down to go die with Jesus. So, off they go to face death. Now, skip a whole bunch. Down in verse 44, Jesus says, Lazarus, come out. Actually, I need to open this again. Hello, Bible, my old friend. This is actually the Bible I did my Bible school in, so it's got some notes in here, little question marks by every other verse. It's great. So, Jesus says in verse 44, Lazarus, come out. And then it says, the man who had died came out, his hands and feet bound with linen strips, his face wrapped with a cloth. Jesus said to them, unbind him and let him go. Something beautiful about this moment. Lazarus came out of the tomb, still bound to his dead clothes. These clothes are unclean culturally. They've been touching a dead body for 4 days. Jesus says, go to these other guys around him. Go touch that guy. Go take off his unclean clothes. He's making all these people unclean. Jesus does that. He breaks our expectations, our cultural expectations. But I want to talk about, there we are, burial clothes. So that's what he was wrapped in, more or less. Of course, this is modern fabric made probably in Vietnam. But the body is wrapped with one large shroud all the way around. It's not that his hands and feet were all wrapped separately, like each leg was separately wrapped. It was all wrapped together. And there was a separate cloth covering his face. So Lazarus wakes up, and he can't see anything at all. And he can't move his arms or legs. I don't know how he came out of the tomb, but I imagine he kind of did the worm. He got his way out. Maybe he was like, just hopping along. Maybe he crawled. I don't know. It was not an easy way out of that. So it said he was in a cave, right? They put him in a cave. They put him deep in a cave where animals won't get to them, where light won't get to the body. They want the body to decay. In Jewish culture, the body decays. When it's just bones, they go and take a box and put it with the rest of the family. So Lazarus is deep in a cave. It has to crawl his way out. Jesus says, hey, to the people around him, go take off the clothes that are binding him. There was this brief moment where Lazarus is in between life and death, where he's still wrapped in death, so to speak. There's something to be said. This isn't like a main application or anything, but sometimes we need other people's help to get out of death. What happens in this first part and then that last verse there, we see these people courageously go headfirst into a difficult situation that hurts. It's a close friend who's died here, right? It's also Judea wanting to kill all of them. There's a lot of reasons to not do this, but Jesus leads them into it anyway. And so sometimes our obedience to Jesus is not going to look safe. When we were in Guatemala, day like two, we found out that the pastor we're supposed to stay with the next week, his brother was just shot and killed. Were we in a safe place? No. This was in April last year, so almost a year ago. No, we were not in a safe place. Not at all. But we stayed. What were we going to do? Peace out? The pastor's brother just died, so we went to the funeral. We preached at it. We got to bless the people, right? Jesus leads us into dangerous situations. And they're way beyond what we expect. And that takes what? Courage. So, that's one point. And we'll come back to it when we kind of wrap it all together. Something else to talk about, though, is from verses 17 through 27 and then 38 through 43. We'll paraphrase a bit. We have Mary and Martha that come to Jesus in different ways, but very similar ways. They say exactly the same words. Mary says, "Lord, if you had been here, Lazarus, or my brother, would not have died." Martha says, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But even now I know that whatever you ask of God, he will give you." Jesus confronts Martha. To Mary, he just says, "Take me to him," and weeps together with her. There's something different about these two. There's a lot of things that are different about these two, but one of those things is that Mary fell to his feet. Mary spends a lot of time at Jesus' feet. There's some other stories about her sitting at his feet, listening to his teachings. She has a closeness with him that's different. And she, I don't think she says, "If you'd been here, my brother wouldn't be dead." I think she says, "If you'd been here, my brother wouldn't have died." And I think that Jesus, in that moment, simply sees her sorrow and steps into her sorrow with her. Martha comes with a little bit of a different attitude. Now, Martha's also a close friend of Jesus. Let's not, like, pretend Martha's the enemy here. Some people think, oh, Mary and Martha, like, oof, Martha sucks. Like, no, Martha's not bad, okay? But she comes to Jesus in a different heart. She says, "You could have healed him. Why didn't you come on time?" That's my paraphrase of that. They surely expected the messenger to get there and Jesus to make haste to go be with Lazarus, but instead he spends 2 days sitting around. Maybe he was healing Bartimaeus in Jericho, I don't know. But he spent 2 days before he went to Bethany. So when he gets there to Martha, I want to talk about Martha. Martha says, "Lord, if you'd been here, my brother wouldn't be dead, but whatever you ask of God, God will give you." And Jesus, he replies to her, "Your brother will rise again." That's his reply. Martha says, "I know that he'll rise again in the resurrection on the last day." That's the belief of the Jews, is that there will be a last day when the Messiah comes and all the people are resurrected, right? It's actually kind of close to what Christians believe. Jesus then says, "I am the resurrection and the life." It follows it up, but not too many details here. Jesus takes Martha from believing in what he could have done or should have done, according to her expectations, to believing in him for who he is. "I am the resurrection and the life" is an identity statement. He's not saying, "I do resurrection and I give life." He's saying, "I am the resurrection and the life." So that's who he is. And he's saying to Martha, Ben's English version, he's saying, "Martha, if you believe in who I am, you should keep expecting that miracle you thought you would see. Because I am the resurrection and the life. I am the healing you hoped for, even though I showed up late, in your opinion." So, Jesus is raising her level of faith. He's saying, "Take your faith in what I would have done or should have done or could have done and put it in who I am and simply invite me into it." So, I have a picture up here. Thanks, Natalie. So, this is related. First of all, I had to find this. I said, "What is this thing called?" Who knows what this is called? We have all played with one, probably. But I Googled it. I'm like, okay, box with shapes corresponding to items that have a similar shape to put in the box. Like, what is this thing called? And that came up, so I guess it worked. It turns out it's called a shape sorter cube. So, oftentimes we have a problem, right? And our problem is hexagon-shaped. There's no hexagons up there. So our problem is octagon-shaped, right? But we only know the God who looks like a star. Yeah, there is a star. Good. Okay. In this image. We only know that God can bring stars because one time we had a problem and it was star-shaped and God brought us a little star and we popped it in the hole and it worked. But when we have an octagon shape, we go, okay, God, you have to bring a a star, because it's what I know you can do. Mary knew Jesus could heal. I don't know. Sorry, Martha knew Jesus could heal. I don't know if she knew that he could resurrect. But oftentimes we expect God to show up with a problem, or sorry, with a solution that fits our image of the problem, what we think the problem looks like. God's solution is usually bigger. This is why I talked about my phone. I thought I needed an iPhone. My parents knew I didn't. There's times when Jesus shows up late. He shows up after Sunday service. He shows up in a different context than what we expected, looking different than what we thought he would, and not doing what we wanted him to do. In those moments, we have two choices. We can either blame him for not showing up on time, or we can say, Jesus, I'm glad you showed up. I know who you are. Do what you're going to do. Be who you are. So, we'll move on from the cube. We can't put God in a box. Not that box, but in a box. In general, we can't fit him within our expectations. So the last bit I want to paraphrase is to show this part. Let me look at my notes. Okay, so the Jews have different reactions in this story. They're another like character set. They're sort of supporting side characters, but they're there. So Mary goes, right? Mary goes and she weeps before Jesus and says, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. And Jesus, seeing her and the Jews around her weeping with her. Lazarus must have been an important guy. He must have been a guy who did good, because he evidently had a lot of friends who were here to mourn. So Jesus sees all of these people around, and he goes and he says, take me to the tomb. And he goes to the tomb and he weeps. It says Jesus wept. It's a lot of people's favorite memory verse because it's quite short. Jesus wept. When Jesus wept, the Jews saw him and had two reactions. Some said, look how he loves, or loved him. And the other said, could not the man that opened the eyes of the blind man also have healed Lazarus, also have stopped him from dying? They think, because two chapters earlier in John chapter 9, he healed a blind guy who had been blind from birth. There was a whole discussion there that we're supposed to remember and be like, oh yeah, in that story, Jesus said his blindness is not because of his sin, but because God wants to be glorified in his healing. We remember that. We also remember when he said earlier in chapter 11, this sickness is not unto death, but for the glory of God, and that the Son of God might be glorified. We see some connections, and these Jews also see a connection, and they say, you healed the blind guy, why didn't you heal Lazarus? They blame him. They blame Jesus for Lazarus dying. They say, if you loved him, you would have saved him. You don't love him, and it's your fault he's dead. How often in our lives do we have moments where something doesn't go right, and we say, God, you could have stopped this. And if you loved me, you would have. And suddenly, we are not in God's love anymore. Not that he stopped loving us, but we stopped believing in it. We go, God, you don't love me because you didn't stop that thing from happening. This response happens. And then at the very end of this, in 45 and 46, it says, many of the Jews, therefore, who had come with Mary and had seen what he did, believed in him. The Jews that believed are connected with Mary's attitude. But some of them went to the Pharisees and told them what Jesus had done. The Jews in Judea, going to the Pharisees to say, hey, Jesus is here and he's raising people from the dead, know that they're trying to get him stoned, which means hit with rocks to die, not Colorado things. So they're trying to get Jesus killed. That's what's happening here. It's not just like, oh, guess what, guys? Good news, Lazarus is alive. No, it's like, bad news, Jesus is here, and we need to kill him. That's what they're saying to the Pharisees, because they're in the region that wants to kill Jesus. So, I think that based on the way the narrative rolls here, we're supposed to understand that the Jews who earlier said he should have shown up earlier and healed Lazarus are the same ones that go and try to get Jesus killed. I want to propose that the attitude of our hearts when we say, Jesus, you should have grown up in the way that I expected and you didn't and you don't love me anymore is the very same attitude that crucifies him. It's not the attitude that brings us closer to him. So, I think there's a picture of two roads. Yeah. Anyway, you have two options. There's two heart postures. Blame in arrogance toward God for not showing up the way we expect him to, or a humble expectation of him to be who he is, even though he's not doing it how I thought he would. So when we're in these moments of our life, of grief, of change, of challenge, of occasionally opportunity even, can lead us to a place where God should do things my way, and he will do things his way. When he does things his way, Lazarus is resurrected. When God does things his way, when Jesus waits 2 days, Lazarus is raised from the dead. That's pretty cool. I like that. I want to raise the dead. Jesus said I can. Mark said I can. John said I can. Matthew said I can. Because of him, right? I want to see that someday. So if Jesus did it, if Peter did it, if Paul did it, let's go for resurrection. Anyway, that's a side note. It's for free. Don't worry. But the point is, when Jesus does things his way, there's a resurrection. When the people get what they want, there might be a healing, which is cool. But it's not as cool as resurrection, to put it simply. I want to use this image. In the text, it's like, okay, is healing or resurrection better? I can't decide. That's for God to decide. But I want to propose that resurrection is an example for us of a new life, of living a new life in Christ. Not a life where we're actually still dead in him. We think we see him. We want him to do stuff. We have our hopes placed in him. But we don't believe in who he is. That's a dead Christianity. Even though we know what he looks like, we know what he does, we know where to expect him on Sunday mornings, we don't know him the way Mary did. When she said, Jesus, my brother has died, and she invites him into the morning. She says, come into my grief, come into this place where I am hurting, where I have lost somebody. I don't blame you for what happened, Jesus. I know who you are, and if there's a resurrection in mind, do it. But I know who you are, so come into this place with me. And she's the one that believes. She's the one that gets the resurrection in this moment. She's the one that gets to see that. I mean, I imagine Martha was there too. They all got to see it, right? But the person who has the attitude of Jesus, be who you are. I believe in who you are, not what you do for me. That's the person that begins to live fully in Christ. That's the person who lives a resurrected life. So, let's kind of wrap it together. So Jesus starts all this by leading people into death. Everyone in this story has an encounter with mortality. Lazarus has a pretty awesome encounter with mortality. He gets to die and come back. A detail I didn't mention about his death is that in the Jewish mindset, according to the Talmud is some cultural stuff the Jews added on to the Old Testament in the 400s to zero time before Jesus. The mindset of the Jews during this time is that when a person dies, their soul visits their body for up to 3 days until decay sets in and the body starts to smell. And at that time, the soul leaves permanently. So by showing up on day 4, Jesus is popping their bubbles. He is blowing their minds. He's saying, guys, you think that up to day 3 a resurrection is actually possible, but today it's impossible. But today's the day I'm going to do it. So, that's cool. Jesus leads them into death. He leads everyone into an encounter with mortality. All of his disciples have to risk their lives to go to be with Jesus. They could have said, you know what, I'm not going, but they want to be where he is. So they go into death with Jesus. Now, these guys got 3 years with him, 3 direct years discipling with him, living life with him. So I imagine that by this time, he's not far from the cross. They are ready, like in their minds and their hearts, they are firmly ready to die with him. And we need that kind of courage. We need to speak like Thomas, let's go and die with Jesus in order to live into the fullness of life that God has for each of us. We have to lay down our comforts. We have to, first of all, spend time with Jesus. I don't know where y'all are at. You know, everyone has their individual journey, but there is a sacrifice that needs to be made daily to simply listen to God. Sometimes we pray too much. We speak too much. We tell him everything we want, and we keep putting our expectations on him. But if we would just listen, he will get outside our box. He will challenge us into uncomfortable territory and send us to places like Guatemala, where the pastor's brother died. We will be in danger sometimes, but he will be with us. If we get into that place and ask God, God, where do you want me? Use me, God, anywhere in this world. He will lead you. But there has to be a desperate question there. I know of a lady. I never met her. She was 75. Her husband had died. She was very retired. She's from Chile. She, at the age of 75, decided she would have not spent her life in a meaningful way. She decided to go to India, spend the rest of her life there helping the poor. I'm not talking about Mother Teresa. That would be cool, too. She did something similar. But this lady, she was from Chile. I don't even remember her name, but I was at her memorial service in Santiago, Chile. She was sent out by YWAM, Youth with a Mission, and she died in India. She said, bury my heart here. Bury my body here. There's many people like her throughout history. But I use her as an example because even if you're 75, you're not too old, it's not too late. Ask God, what can I do that will mean something to this world, that will bring that resurrection life that you have for me to others? And in bringing it to others, you will live into it yourself. But you have to have courage to take those risks. We have to release our expectations. We have to expect him to be the answer and not the way we think he should do things. Especially when we go into risky situations like his disciples, we don't have the answers. We have no idea what to do in these situations. I remember I was in a tribe in Mexico. They're an unreached tribe, but this village had a few churches, so they were a reached village. A friend who lives in that village, her name's Gladys. She's a local. Her cousin committed suicide while we were there. He killed himself. We heard about it. The whole village went to a funeral. And we, as a missionary team, we were like, are we welcome at the funeral? They're going to do some cultural customs. They have a little shamanism mixed in there. Not really sure if we should go, like what this should look like. It was really hard to know what to do in this situation because these people are living an indigenous shamanistic religion life with some churches. Is how things are in this place. And so, do we go? What do we do? We just got on our knees. We just cried out. We said, God, raise him from the dead. Why not? Jesus, raise this kid from the dead because the whole village will see you in that. It didn't happen. That was our hope. That was our expectation. We asked for it. And in asking, God meets us with his answers, right? Even if we ask for the wrong thing, he still shows up a few days late and gives us his answer. I don't know what the final outcome of that time was, but instead, you know, we got done praying. We said, all right, God, it's in your hands now. We just went and sat with the family. We spent hours with them and just said, hi, guys. How's life? Just sat with them. They didn't want to talk necessarily. We just sat, ate some food together, knitted some little bead things they call chaquita down there. All that to say, we had no answer for the question, for the problem. We didn't have the star-shaped answer to the hole in our box. But we definitely had a hole in our box of what God should do in this situation. There's times in our lives that might be a little more applicable here in Craig when, you know, that, whatever, the lease can't be renewed. We got to find a new place to live, where maybe we lose someone, we lose a job, we're looking for something new to do. Maybe our lives just feel a little meaningless and we want to do something more meaningful for God too. I don't know. But he will be the answer, and the only way to get to his answer is to yeah, ask honestly with our expectations, but then release them. Let him be him. You will get to know him better when you ask the hard questions, and yet have the humility to listen once you're done asking. And then lastly, we got to make room for Jesus, right? Mary takes him to the tomb. They're there. Martha's there. Jesus is like, move the stone aside. You don't do that. It smells bad. The guy's dead. It's unclean. Culturally, you stay away from this. You don't move the stone aside. Jesus says, move it aside. That's way outside of our thinking. But in doing this, he raises their level of faith, right, to trust him to be him, even though it's impossible to raise this guy from the dead now in their mindset. In their 3 days have passed, now the soul is departed mindset. So what he's about to do is impossible to them. Like, it is, God cannot resurrect a person on the fourth day, according to the Jewish mindset. Back in. That was over here. Back in. We need to make room for Jesus to do things his way. In the midst of change, of loss, of death, of challenges, we cannot accuse him like the Jews. That's where I wanted to go with this. We cannot accuse him when we do, when we blame him, when we say, Jesus, you should have been here and it would have gone better, but you weren't here. You didn't show up the way I wanted you to. We lose our opportunity to get to know him better. When we ask the questions with an arrogant heart, when we blame him for not showing up with our answer, we lose the opportunity to know Jesus. We lose the opportunity to experience his love and his miracles for us. His power will break in on our lives, but it takes humility to let him be him. So, don't be the guy that crucifies Jesus, that takes him to the Pharisees. Don't be those Jews. The people we want to be are the ones that believe, the ones that see, and instead of saying in the midst of their grief, he should have fixed it, they say, look how much he loved this person too. Isaiah 63:19, 19, 13, somewhere in there, 63, says, in their afflictions he was afflicted. That means that he feels our sorrow and our pain. And when we let him feel it with us, God is an emotional God. I hate to burst any very Western mindsets here, but God feels a lot of emotions. Go read the Bible. It's full of it. And in our Western mindset, we think he doesn't. We think he's very stoic. We think he's way over there and untouchable and never changes. He changes his emotions regularly. He feels what we feel. And when we let him feel with us, when we invite him to show his weeping, they saw his weeping, right? They said, Jesus wept. And the Jews said, look how he loved Lazarus. They're saying he must hurt like we hurt. And in that moment, they're identifying with Jesus. They're getting to know something about him that few know. Up to this point in the Gospels, Jesus doesn't weep. This is where he mourns deeply. And Jesus feels that kind of emotion. So does God. Jesus is God. So we have an opportunity in hardship to let him in, to let him feel and be him with us, or to blame him for not showing up. Pick one and stick it out. Do it. That's the trick here. It's hard to get our hearts in the right place, but to do it practically, we have to speak. Because from the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. So speak out what you want your heart to be filled with. It goes both ways. You say, I want to blame God right now, but God, I know that you loved me, you loved this person, you loved this place, you want the best for us. And in doing so, you will tell your heart what to do, what to believe. David says, bless the Lord, O my soul. David spent most of his life either running from King Saul or his son Absalom, ready to be killed. And David spoke to his own soul and said, bless the Lord. The Bible's full of these examples of people who say to their hearts what to do, what to believe, and what to feel. Speak with your mouth, out loud, in your prayer time, with your husband, wife, whatever, and your heart will change. So if you find yourself blaming God, you're not lost, you're Martha, And it's time to raise your faith to believe in him, not what he should have done. So, to close my sermon, I want to wrap it back up with the phone story. Yesterday, I was at Prodigal Sons, the coffee shop, not the church, and it was delicious coffee, some good scones and things, and there was this wonderful old lady sitting at a table, waiting for, I think, her table partner, whoever, probably a daughter or something, I don't know, but that came back and was talking to her afterward. But while she was waiting, my wife said, "Look at that wrinkly, cute old lady." Steph loves wrinkles, which is great, because someday I'm going to be very wrinkly. And she said, "Look at that wonderful, cute old lady. She's not on her phone like anyone else would be while they're waiting. She's just sitting there looking around." And I know that in that moment, that lady got an experience of life. Because she wasn't given something that she wasn't able to handle at a young age. Of course, it didn't exist at her age, but she had no opportunity to fall into that trap, right? At another table, there was a young couple, some sort of date, hanging out. I don't know, maybe they were just friends. They were on their phones for like half of the time they were there, just looking at their phones, sending some messages, scrolling a bit, showing each other a funny meme or whatever, but that was it. This lady, even though she was alone at the table during that time, had a better experience of life than these people who had no human connection sitting across from each other. This is a silly example, but it's a real example where if somebody's given something that is what they expect, the way they think God should do it, when it's not who God is for that situation, they will lose the opportunity to fully live going forward. So I'm glad my parents didn't give me a phone when I was 14 that had, you know, a browser on it and Facebook or whatever, because I got to understand that what that older lady has is a fuller life. And I'm glad, I'm thankful for the moments when God hasn't done for me what I thought he should have done. Though it hurts, I can say thank you, God, for these moments where I thought you should have been or done whatever it was. You should have healed my shoulder. I had a car accident in 2019. My shoulder hurt for a long time after that. Prayer after prayer by people who see healings regularly. In the mission field, this is normal, guys. I don't know what normal looks like in Craig, but healings are normal. People pray for me, and my shoulder is not healing. I don't know why. I can't say, God, you taught me something through this, so that's why. No, I can't justify it. It is not my place to justify why he didn't heal my shoulder. Don't make a theology out of God not doing the healing. Don't do that. But he was God in those moments too. And I'm thankful for the moment that he did heal my shoulder. Months later, I was in a room with some people. They were practicing words of knowledge. Go read 1 Corinthians 12. It's biblical. They were saying, there's someone in this room with a left shoulder that hurts. That's this shoulder. This was my shoulder that hurt. So I didn't raise my hand. They went, they prayed for her, and when the moment they laid their hands on her, my shoulder popped. And it hasn't hurt since. I don't know what's up, but God chose that moment to be God in that way to me. That's the only time I've ever experienced physical healing. I've prayed, I've seen physical healings for people from my own prayers. But I've experienced one, and I have asked for many. So let me tell you, God is God, and when I just invite him into the questions instead of blaming him, I get to experience the fullness of who he is. So let me pray, and then Steph's going to share something. Jesus, thank you for the moments when you don't show up on time. Thank you for who you are to each of us. In our challenges, in the change of life, in death, in loss, God, in sickness, in brokenness, in poverty, in all of these moments, you are there. And like Paul, God, I just cry out that we would each be able to say, I know how to live in abundance and in poverty, in sickness and in health. These are not marriage vows, but God, you know what I mean. That we would be able to say, I am content in all things because I can do all things through him who strengthens me. Paul is content in those moments of pain because Jesus is with him. And God, I ask that Jesus would be the answer to our pain. Your person would be the answer to moments of pain and opportunity, to moments of poverty and abundance, God. That Jesus would be the answer in each of our lives. That we would let go of our expectations of what you will do, but receive who you are and know that you will do things in accordance to who you are. And you are resurrection and life. And you are gracious and merciful and slow to anger, abundant in steadfast love and faithfulness. And so that is who you are in every situation. And we just ask for more of your presence in each person's life here, Lord. That they would receive the fullness of who you are. That they would ask the hard questions, but without blame in their hearts, and receive the Jesus who would weep by our side. Thank you, Jesus. In Jesus' name we pray, amen. Steph?